in your response to part two of that online response on the drawings, and you say you're going to provide that.
Let me. Should have put stickies in here.
I think
it's 45. Yeah, so what's confusing is that the star change pages aren't numbered.
15-3.
REI response,
and then it's not ground.
You don't require a response. You'll include that. Okay.
We didn't include that because we didn't review those big reports and look at that. We were just looking to make sure we were giving you the information that you were asking.
I informed
that you was acceptable to you.
Right. I understand. And that's perfectly fine. I just wanted to, I thought that's what the highlighting meant. I just wanted to clarify that. I think, you know, I know we had some discussion on the GTCC thing and on 15-4. My comment here is I haven't looked at all of those transportation star sections that you've referenced in your REI responses. I did look at the one for the NAC UMS and hoping that would be a good example. I don't have any additional questions on this with respect to this in the course of the review, we're going to have, I mean, there's obviously, as you know, there are other disciplines involved here. You know what those are, you know, so you've got, you know, thermal and structural and confinement and shielding reviewers. But I think the information that you provided there in terms of, you know, the information in that. Along with the addition that you have in as H3 on the design criteria. Okay, 15-5, which is I think it was a simple bookkeeping item, so no questions on that. But I do appreciate the fact that you've gone through and identified other areas where there was a similar issue and provided those corrections. So that prevents us from having to go back to that same issue again. So thank you for that. Okay, yeah. I know that you provided the response to... Have you actually provided a response to 15-6? I know you've indicated the change page, but what was done in the SR, are the code exceptions, was that a separate document, or did you incorporate that by reference?
We incorporated by reference. We point you to the table in the SR that has the code.
Okay. Okay, and then you identify that in your, so your change here, your change page in the SAR just basically points to that.
That's correct. We have a reference to table 3114, and in our response we tell you that it's in 3114, and we will revise the SAR to point to it.
Okay.
Yeah, that was an oversight on my part.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you very much for that. That helps. I don't have any questions on 15-7. We always have to ask about the training thing because it was never really done consistently, and most of the time we recognize that codings are classified as not important to safety, but it seems like we always have to ask that question. And I appreciate the revised drawings on 15-8. Having actually stood next to a transformer, I'm sitting there going, yeah, I think that's 90 inches. administration task above the you know, attachment points for the training. So your analysis is appreciated, as well as the clarification drawings that show how this operation is going to actually take place and be more representative of what you're actually planning to do. So again, I don't have any other questions there, but I do appreciate the response and the clarification drawings that you've provided. I'm looking at 59, another GTCC related question, and we talked about the additional principal design criteria in H3. I'm fine with that. I haven't checked the values that you've added to the SAR in 1510, but you know, the one thing that I'll just look at and say are more or less correct are, you know, things like density and modulus of elasticity. So we will check those values, but thank you for providing that information as well. Okay. I understand the response to 1512, that you're not planning to use AP-187 for a containment type purpose, even though that is included in the SR for that system. So appreciate that clarification.
And it was never licensed for that. While it's included in the SAR, it's never been implemented because it was never licensed.
Yeah,
right. So it couldn't be, so we couldn't incorporate it by reference anyway because it was never approved.
Okay. I will, since your response to 1513 is lengthy and somewhat complicated, I would appreciate maybe if we could spend some time going through that and if you could provide a description of what you did and how you did it. You indicated that, you know, that you, some things you included, some things you didn't include, and there were reasons for that. If you don't mind going through that, I think that would be helpful. I do appreciate the response, but what I'm looking at now is you provided this large set of information that we essentially haven't reviewed. And, you know, as much as it's possible for us to do so, I'd like to get, you know, to at least discuss this in some amount of detail so you can provide, you know, your rationale for what you did. And hopefully what that's going to do is, you know, if we have something where there's, you know, we have to ask additional questions, we can ask that. You can make sure you provide that information so we don't have to go back to you with, you know, for additional information. Just keep in mind you're providing us now a whole lot of information that, you know, we certainly have reviewed that in terms of renewals, like the 1,020 renewal and what we have ongoing with the Rancho Seco renewal, but, you know, we haven't reviewed really what you provided in your version of it. So let's just hear more about that.
Unfairs might not be the right word, but when we originally submitted, we didn't have the licensure renewal hadn't been approved. We made the commitment to include it once it was approved, and in the intervening time it became approved, so we're not dumping, as you said, this is a lot of information that we're trying to incorporate, and I agree it's not straightforward because it's not a general license, we have a specific site, and so some of the stuff that was general now has to become specific. And we tried in our response here in the table to explain to you what our thinking was. Do you want to go through it now at a high level, or do you think it would be worth having a separate meeting after you've had a chance to really look through it?
I think what I have to do is, you know, for you to touch on each one of these, you know, the points that you have here, you know, recognizing that, you know, this is, along the other responses that you have, this is the one that I see that's going to be, okay, well, this might be, you know, it's a lot of information, so we might have some additional questions later on. Whatever we can do to get those clarified now, I think would be, you know, worth your time and worth our time to do so.
All So start on page 58 and just go through the rest. Is
that
informed us?
Yeah.
Okay. So, number 1927.1 was not the standard when the 1004 was not
allowed. Mm-hmm.
And so, because all of the licensure rules that we're trying to deny the online systems have are adopting that, I'll call it cadence.
Mm-hmm.
What we did is we arranged our program element requirements to align with the new rate. So, that's just for bookkeeping. So, if we're going to do any substantive of changes, we just rearranged how it was laid out. It did not change any requirements in the AMPs, as we say there in the last statement. So, it's all the same information that's in 1004 approved licensure renewal. It's just that we reordered it to be consistent with what the standard is today.
So the 10 AMP program elements, those are all identified, and you identify the information that you need there. Okay. All right.
That's what I believe.
Okay.
So SMSIS license for high amount of fuel, license application for the new homes. We don't have anything. In this license application, we're intended to use the secondary cam for fuel and for homes that have a secondary cams licensed in what we're incorporating by reference. And so because it doesn't apply in this license amendment, there is no high burnout fuel.
Okay.
To be stored in new homes, so we removed it.
Okay.
Obviously, if we come in for an amendment in the future to add high amount of fuel in new homes, then we'll have to revisit this as part of that submittal.
Right.
But that's for bullet number two. For the transfer task, we're not using the OS-197 or any of the transfer tasks that are licensed in 1004. There's several of them that are licensed in there. We're using the transportation task as our transfer task.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't include the transfer tasks because the transportation tasks obviously have to be current in order to bring the fuel there. And so we would only be using current transportation tasks. So we didn't include any AMPs for those because we don't. We don't have anything for those.
Okay, so what? After you get everything loaded, you know, if you get a license app, if you get a license approved, and you load the cask into their overpacks or HSMs, are you planning to keep transportation casks on site or not?
We will have to have access to a transportation cask, but that's the only thing. For moving new homes, I'm just speaking about new homes, we have to have access to a transportation cask. I'm not sure we have to have one on the site, but we have to have access to them because they're not, that's the only thing that's going to be in this license that's approved for being transfer operations.
Right.
They have not brought over the other casks.
So the approach you're taking here is that because if you only have access to it, you're going to lease it, you know, or something like that, then the aging management, whatever happens with that transfer cast, you're basically putting it in your leasing agreement or purchase agreement or whatever that, you know, if, you know, this thing is, you know, beyond whatever, however many years, if it's the MP-187 system, that you have, you know, requisite aging management program for that. If it's something else, it's only licensed for transport, then, yeah, I understand. You've got a maintenance system, and those things are renewed every 5 years. That's your licensing. Okay.
Yeah, so our argument is they're renewed every 5 years, so it's by definition has to be kept current. But we don't have any other transfer casks that are authorized for use at this facility.
Will that change with the NAC systems?
So for NAC, because for NAC, they don't use their transportation cash as a transfer cask. So they will, their transportation cask comes and it basically,
yeah,
and there's the crossover between 71 and 72, because under 72 we have to operate their cask. So for the MAC systems it will be different because their cash transfer system will be subject to aging management and all their parts.
Yeah, I understand that, but what I'm asking is, are you planning to have that transfer cask for the NAC systems on site?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that will be, so you will have to have, okay,
yes,
sorry,
yes,
eventually, whenever it crosses its,
yes.
Okay.
I believe there's two of them, but yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, because they only had used this transfer cask.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, our system is much different.
Right. Okay.
Their transfer cask is part of their transfer system.
Right.
And we take ours all the way out to the pad. Theirs just stays in that cask transfer or cask handling building. And then the overpack is taken out to the...
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
So the HSM inlet and ventilation AMPs, there weren't any aging mechanism or effects that were identified to deal with the for the vents. And blockage of the vents is already something that has to be inspected for every, I think it's 24 hours. So we didn't include that because it's already part of the regular operating requirements.
And your building with HSM's new?
Correct.
Okay.
We need references to the renewal and the CFC 1004 amendments, because this is a new application, so we don't have to, we can have to include all that description. Define extended period of operation. The terminology there was in the original 1004, if I understand this correctly, had to do with the 1000 in the 1004. We're going to hit the 20 years before the renewal would have been approved, and so you had this extended. That doesn't apply here because we're not going to hit the 20 years before this is approved. This needs to be approved as part of the initial application. So
right,
that's what that was about. The next one. Obviously, we don't have a Part 50 program that we're, QA program that we're falling back on. We're using our 72 program that's approved as for this site. So we don't point to the utilities Part 50 programs anymore. Change references to general licensees, because the general licensees in this case don't exist. It's a specific license and it's us.
Right.
212 report, obviously we won't be writing a 212.
Right.
The inspection criteria, to be consistent with what we are proposing, again, it's coming from around the country, and what we've committed to in the SAR and what we're carrying forward with here is that we're going to strengthen as though they're still, in a sense, still at the originating site. So if it was in a marine environment, the fact that we are not going to be in the marine environment, we still want them to be treated and monitored as if they were there, because we're not. So what we did was, it's from the on-site, we have calculations for what inspections you need to do based on what site they came from, not our site.
Okay, but in the 1004 renewal, I'm trying to remember what there was in there that was site dependent.
Another basically was if you're in a marine environment or not. So the rules for a place like Oyster Creek would be different than somebody in the middle of the country, Fort Calhoun.
Okay. And then there was also, it doesn't apply because it was, you know, country aging, but there was also a different, there was a specific criteria there in terms of groundwater chemistry. But that one was actually the first one that came to my mind.
Okay.
That was one very specific difference, but that's not applicable here because you're with respect to that system, you're in your initial license period.
Right.
Okay.
The next one has to do with the grace period for first inspections. Obviously, we don't need a grace period because we'll be receiving them at the site, and we'll have a license before they show up. So,
and the highlighted portion here is, again, something that you're going to still provide.
I think this is there was a question about what this is referring to. So we'll.
Okay, so that's maybe a note for you, not me.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's some information here to make sure we don't, when we submit it finally, we color code them so that we don't miss anything.
I do the same thing.
remove reference to standardized new homes, dry storage system, design speeds intention to have a single set of AMPs for all new homes. Okay, yeah. So, the standardized new homes dry storage system, that was typically the 1,400 as we're proposing new homes, and so we want to use the same AMP, one AMP. One set of AMPs for all the new homes.
Right, so that would be the 61 BT, 61 BTH, all of the 24 PT1s, and the Rancho Seco canister.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So have you, okay, so the Rancho Seco renewal is ongoing, is in process. Are you aware of what's in that renewal? Have you had the opportunity to take a look at it? Okay, so you.
Yeah, and I'm getting encouragement to revise mine to be more like that, to revise these to be more like that, because apparently there are things that are changing, we want to stick with what's approved because
that means right. So they're not even. We have some eyes on that. They're not even going to respond to that until the end of the month. So, you know, we've got questions on their aging management program. I mean, I guess, you know, my point in asking the question is really more of, you know, have you looked at the differences between the 1004 system that these amps are covering and any unique differences in the Rancho Seco systems? Having been to Rancho Seco, I can tell you that all the nameplates say 72-1004 on them all on the HSMs. I get that. So it's basically, you know, that's the system is designed after. But are there differences that you have to consider in those systems and take account for in the amp, or are they just so similar?
My understanding. And one of them was preparing the 1029 license, which covers the 24 PT1.
Right.
So we've also looked at those to see what they're doing. And my understanding is that those are going to be more simplified than what 1004 had in it. They're aiming to make it more simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to propose something that you haven't approved yet that is more simple, which in my mind would require justification. I would prefer to stick with what you've already approved. And the 1004 covers a site like Rancho Seco if it had been a general license,
mm-hmm.
and covers
the 1029 also. So we make the argument why we believe it's applicable. And what I've been told is, from what I understand from looking at the revised AMPs that we're proposing, it would simplify some things for us.
Okay. So I guess, you know, really the only one that you have that you're bringing over is the canister. The HSMs are new. You're not dealing with it, anything like that. So I guess the real key here is, have you gone through, you know, this, you know, the basically make sure that the 72-1004 amps that you're going to apply to these other systems cover the breadth of, you know, the important safety structure systems and components and the aging management review that goes along with that, so that you're not, you know, you haven't left something out. So some of the things that we've seen before, just to, you know, kind of give you a heads up, is, you know, when we go through the 1004 renewal, you know, we would find things like, you know, on the top of the lid, there's a test plug on some of the systems. And for some of those systems, you know, it was not mentioned as part of, you know, something that was covered by the aging management program. So, you know, we had to go through and ask REIs. And if you look at the first round of REIs for the 72-1004 system, you know, for the renewal, the initial renewal application for the DSCs, probably, I'm going to say that maybe the first 10 REIs were all associated with, you know, questions on the aging management review. You know, it's, you know, when we look at the drawing, when we look at the important safety classification, we think that, you know, you didn't include this and you should have, kind of thing. And I think in the majority of the cases, the applicant came back and said, yep, that's true, we'll include that. So just up front, you know, based on our experience, you know, make sure that you've covered those things, and if there's some unique aspects to these other systems that, you know, where we haven't completed our review, where you look at those and you say, yeah, I've got to address that in you know, the aging management program for this particular system. Doesn't mean you have to have something necessarily unique for that system, but it has to be addressed in the aging management program.
Okay. So you can probably tell, I mean, I'm not familiar with this. The people who are doing the SMART review are doing the SMART work in our shop at Transnuclear, and are working on 1029 are the same people that did this for me, as they're doing both. And the SMART canisters are also part of 1004. Under a different name,
right?
But the design is in the 1004 license, and that's true for the 24PT1 also is included in the design. So I'm confident that there are, but I'll take a note to go back and ask them to make sure that there's nothing you need.
The other thing we've asked in renewals, and so it feels a little bit awkward asking this question here and an initial review, but one of the things that we found has been beneficial for us when we do the review is to have the aging management review results in an Excel file so it can be sorted. And if you don't provide that, we'll put it in Excel for you. You'll pay for it, but that's probably not what you want to do. And really, you know, we get these tables in there. You know, they seem to be pretty small fonts, and you know, we try to scribble notes on them, and you know, that's, you know, that kind of thing is difficult to do. It's just much easier to keep track of it if it's in a file that you can.
So these tables you would like us to submit?
Yeah, well, actually, I think the best example, if you go back to the 1004 renewal, and if you look at all those aging management review results table, and there's one, there was actually, I think they broke it up into two tables. You know, it listed, you know, what the safety classification was, it listed what the function was, and the environment that it was in, the material, and whether or not it was covered by an aging management program or a TLAA or whatever it was. So there was a table that was provided in that. And I can go find that in I can give it to John. He can tell you exactly what that table was in that renewal that I'm speaking to. I don't remember right off the top of my head what table it was, but actually it was two sets of tables. It was just useful to have that information in a file that we could sort. It actually expedited our review to do it that way. It's a bit of a pain to go from a PDF to an Excel file, but it was worth our time and effort to do it. I just really don't want to do it again.
Well, I certainly want to make this offer. If we provide any table or whatever in PDF, and you really would like, if you ask John, we'd be more than happy to submit it. We can make it supplemental submittal if there's something you see when you're reviewing that you could use the native file for. We're more than happy to share that with you.
Okay.
Yeah. I will go.
Does that help to sort things out? What's covered by an aging management program? Or what's in a sheltered environment? Or, what's made out of this material and that material? We could go through and we could find that. And that's really how we found a lot of the errors in the aging management review. When we conducted the 72-1004.
Okay. Let's see. I believe we're on the ACI 349.
Right.
So, again, inspection acceptance criteria. We're going to apply those here, so we remove the saying that we're not committed to it. So, and then the last one is just editorial stuff. No intent to change any of the meaning, just to make it read better.
Okay. Yeah, I did see that you have a Appendix C-13. I haven't looked at all of it in detail, but I can see that you submitted that. See where you're referencing that and all the other appendices.
Yeah. We wrote it once. And
right. I understand. I don't think I have really any other questions on that. Is that the last of the non-proprietary?
Yes.
Okay.
And unfortunately, that 13 is proprietary. That was the same proprietary information.
Sure, yeah.
We have a public version and
a
proprietary version.
Right. Are you going to be at least as consistent or aligned with the 72-1004 in terms of the parts of the aging management program that will be publicly available?
Yes. Yeah. Almost considered proprietary in 1004. It's got proprietary here. We didn't make anything.
Okay.
Our intent was not to make anything else proprietary. So I didn't do the proprietary review myself. I asked the folks who knew what we were keeping proprietary to do that review.
Okay. All right. Good. I think that was something the public was interested in as well. Yeah. What that aging management program looked like. Okay. I don't have any other questions on this part of it?
Any comments from ISP?
I just thanks for the feedback and looking forward to getting these AMPs in here.
We're much more versed now, which, the good news is, Tim's already paid the heavy toll for our review of it, so this should be much easier to go through now that we're very familiar. systems and all the drawings associated with them. So
even that review didn't go too poorly.
There was a lot of systems in that
review.
So, different ways can you go to this? It was all work.
So, at this point in time, the business portion of this meeting is concluded. Christine, so if you could please open the line for all the corporate members to ask questions or provide comments. Initially, like I said, we're going to have the question comments like around 1:35, and we 20 minutes earlier. So please go ahead.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question or you do have a comment, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. You must record your first and last name to ask your question or comment, and you may press star, then
program for those systems, but we will do that as part of our review. That's the first one, 15-1.
So that's 15-1.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question or you do have a comment, please press star, then 1, and record your first and last name. Excuse me, this is a conference coordinator. I see you'd like to ask a question. May I have your name, please? Please check your mute button.
If this is Ray Lutz, can I ask my question now?
Yes, and I'm sorry, Ray, your last name was?
Lutz, L-U-T-Z, with Citizens Oversight.
Thank you. One moment.
You will now be placed into conference.
Hello?
The next question comes from Ray Lutz. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi there. Ray Lutz with Citizens Oversight. I see that you are referencing that the studies under severe marine environments have demonstrated that the shell materials are expected to demonstrate minimal corrosion during the 80-year exposure. Now, the thing that I noticed was that these all of these spent fuel systems have a design life of 40 years. That's according to the requirements and what they're licensed under. And then they can possibly be extended. But of course, no one has ever seen them last for 80 years. And that's just a hypothetical idea that they might last that long. And that none of these have actually really been inspected over time to see how well they're doing. And so what basis is this claim being made? What is the studies under severe marine environments that have demonstrated that the materials will last 80 years under severe marine environment exposure? What was those studies? I don't see a reference to that.
So Ray, the information that is the response to the REI, there's a document here, and that document was not provided in this draft REI response, but it will be provided in the response to the REI, and so we will have to get the REI response in order to take a look at that document. But the way these things are licensed, initially everything had a 20-year, a maximum 20-year license, and then after the initial license period, before going into the period of extended operation, specific licensee or a COC holder had to conduct a aging management review, and so they had to look at the important safety structure systems and components, what those important safety functions were,
rehabilitation and in any aging management program that's required for the period of extended operation.
Well, according to Peter Lamb at the...
The next question comes from Michael Keegan. You may ask your question.
I guess they cut me off.
Michael Keegan with Don't Waste Michigan. I heard this question of a transportation cast for the high burn-up. So is this a reusable transportation cast? And will it then be going away from the ISPC or the CISF back to a different facility? What's the potential for transporting this across the country? And how highly contaminated is the overpack or the transportation cask? So if you could address that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, so the transportation cask is licensed under Part 71 of the Code of Federal Regulations. It's our requirements for transporting radioactive materials. Those transportation casks are given a basically a 5-year license, and then they have to be renewed. They have to have a maintenance program. There are specific requirements for transporting in accordance with Part 71, including maximum radiation levels for a transport that includes dose limits, certain distances from the cask and on contact, and then inside of a vehicle which would be operated by somebody transporting the system. In addition to that, there are requirements when the transportation cask is accepted by a licensee, and that's actually in Part 20. They have to do an assessment of the condition of that transportation cask. And determine if it has sustained damage and it's whether or not it's undergone contamination. Once that transportation cask is received and its contents are offloaded, which would be a canister that's self-contained, then that transportation cask is prepared for return shipment. It is then now empty and it is transported back to the next user of that system. And they have to go through the same process of following the requirements in the transportation COC and making sure that the transportation cask, as prepared, meets all the requirements, including radiation dose limits that are in Part 71 and in the transportation COC technical specifications.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question or you do have a comment, please press star then one and record your first and last name. Your line is open.
I'm sorry, I got a follow-up question. So we're talking about essentially doubling the amount of transportation once you get there, then to take the empty cask that is low-level waste or some level of nuclear contamination back across the country and back and forth. So you're essentially doubling the number. And then at the end of the day, the transportation cask becomes low-level nuclear waste. How is that going to be dealt with? And how does that fit into the plan? Thank you.
Okay, so you're not actually doubling the dose to the members of the public, because once the transportation cask is empty, the contents, the radioactive contents are not there. There is the potential to have some contamination. There are required limits to the amount of contamination you can have on the external surfaces of the canister, and those are in the system technical specifications. So you could have some contamination of the surfaces of the transportation cask, but that's pretty low. I can tell you can walk up to a transportation cask. I've walked up to the MP-187 that's on site at Rancho Seco. It is marked appropriately as contaminated material, but you can walk right up to it. The dose limits for that system are the amount of dose in that system from contamination is very low.
At this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Ray Lutz.
After the tone, please state your name.
Ray Lutz.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question or you have a comment, please press star then one and record your first and last name. The next question comes from Ray Lutz. Your line is open.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. A follow-up question from what I was asking before. In terms of the life, the design life of these canisters, I submitted a filing under, I think it's 2.206 or 8.206 anyway. It's the one where it's the rule change submission to the NRC regarding the way these are being stored. Of course, these canisters were only designed for a short period of interim storage before they were supposed to be put into, Yucca Mountain. And so they really weren't designed for these extended time periods that we're now looking at or contemplating. And that one of the things that we want is a much longer period of time, because even if you're looking at 100 years, who knows if they're going to be moved by then. And so the question is the NRC integrating that written filing in the request for the rules examination under regarding these canisters? And under that request, we were asking for probably a dual layer canister design, so that the outer canister could be sacrificial in nature and not and be able to be replaced, instead of just trusting this single layer. That would be one approach to get a 1,000-year life out of it. So how is that filing being integrated into this process? Have you guys at the NRC just forgotten about it completely? Or is it something that when you do one of these filings, as you usually request when we call in, then it's integrated into the process?
Okay, so I'm not actually working. I think what you have is a petition for rulemaking. It's the Helms petition, right?
Yes, that's right.
Hardened storage system, is that correct?
Yeah.
What you're referring to?
Yes, that's actually correct.
Yeah, so I'm not actually conducting the review of that. I know the review of that is being conducted. And so what will have to happen is that that petition for rulemaking will have to go through that process because that's what you've submitted. So if depending on the outcome of your petition for rulemaking, that'll determine what happens going forward.
Well,
until that process is complete.
It's been over a year. It's been over a year since it was submitted. So how long is it going to take to process that? Is it going to take because
I don't know the answer to that, sir. I know he's working on that. We can McCartan, I think, was working on it at one point. We can find out what the status of that petition for rulemaking is and let you know.
Okay, because I think it impacts what you're doing.
You have my contact information. Can you just shoot me an email? Just in case I don't have your email, and then we'll find out.
Okay. I'll just send it to the person on the meeting notice. Is that where I should send it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll do that, certainly. Thank you very much.
Your line is open.
A follow-up question. On the system at Fukushima, when they discovered that the aluminum alloy baskets weren't going to last as long as they hoped, they banned them. How are you ensuring that the aluminum alloy baskets or system have not become degraded? How are you going to, has that been addressed as part of aging management? have also another party that was a high burn of fuel, you know, during the storage, it can continue to degrade. So how are you going to, and it's no service application, you're not going to take damaged fuel. How do you know if it's damaged?
Okay, so in the normal system, anything that's damaged fuel is stored in a damaged fuel can. And I'm not sure.
But the high burn of fuel is not.
They're not asking for high burn of fuel. This application does not include an application for high burn of fuel.
Oh. Okay. But no damaged fuel. So how do you know the fuel hasn't become damaged in storage? How do you know that?
So they have to follow the requirements of our regulations, and they follow the guidance in our interim staff guidance and our standard review plan to determine whether or not fuel met the qualifications for being damaged. And I think
you're not hearing my question. You're not hearing my question. I'm saying after it's in dry, not before you put it in dry storage, but if it becomes damaged during dry storage, this stuff has been sitting here since 2003 at Rancho Seco in 2003 at San Onofre, and even older than that.
You're saying how do you determine whether or not it's been damaged in storage?
Exactly. If you say you're not going to take damaged fuel, how do you know it's damaged?
So there have been you've done assessments of what happens to fuel in storage, and our current understanding of what happens to fuel in storage and even in transportation under normal conditions of transport is the possibility of damage of the fuel is actually very minimal. So
basically, you're going to assume that all the fuel, the non-high burnup we're going to talk about, because you're limiting the scope there, you're going to assume that all the fuel that's sitting around for 20-odd years or 15, 20 years or so has not become damaged over time. That's what you're assuming. Now, we have some canisters that Riva canisters at San Onofre that they had counts per minute of over 2,000 at the inlet air vents of some of them. Some of them are less than 1,000, and it's very unclear to me as to what the heck is going on in those canisters. And it's not high burn fuel, so I
right, so
cannot how you can have that confidence that and assume that this fuel sitting there has not become damaged, those rods or the baskets themselves.
Okay, so there were two separate subjects. I got an answer for you on the basket, but as far as the fuel goes, they have to make a determination prior to transport that the system that they're going to transport meets the requirements of the transport regulation. So if the contents of that, and that includes the contents, so if the contents of that system are not damaged fuel, then you know, they can't transport something that they suspect has damaged fuel without doing some additional assessment. So that's covered in the Part 71 regulations on routine determinations, 7187, I believe. As far as the degradation of the fuel in storage, you know, we have done assessments of what happens to fuel in storage in a storage canister in an inert environment, and you just don't get degradation of the fuel. There's no oxidation of the fuel, the temperature is low enough, you don't get hydride reorientation. You didn't have high burn of fuel to begin with, so hydride reorientation really isn't a significant issue, and there's just really no possibility that unless you've breached containment or somehow dropped the canister, that you have damaged fuel inside of these systems. But I do have an answer for you on the Japanese Society of Mechanical Engineers thing that you're referring to. It's intriguing, but it really isn't applicable to any storage system that we're using in the U.S. Back in 2009 and then it later in 2013, JSME approved several code cases for aluminum and aluminum boron containing materials for spent fuel storage systems. The first ones of those systems were approved in April of 2009, and they included borated aluminum alloys such as 6061. They also included an alloy, a 5000 series alloy, and a boron-containing aluminum metal matrix composite, which was actually approved under ASME, American Society of Mechanical Engineers, under code case N673. And then later on in 2013, there were some additional basket materials that were approved by JSME. These were all 3000 series alloys, which are, again, are alloys that can be heat treated for improved mechanical properties or increased strength. And then sometime after these, that second set of code cases was approved, those code cases were withdrawn. And there was two reasons why they were withdrawn. The first one was the acceptance criteria that they used for these materials, whether they were borated materials or not. They did some impact testing, and as part of impact testing, you do several assessments to determine, you know, the acceptance criteria for those impact tests. One of them is you measure the amount of energy that's absorbed, and the second thing is you measure the amount of deformation of the material. And what they did in these code cases was they used acceptance criteria that was developed for pressure vessel seals for these aluminum alloys, which were a little justified, and that's one of the reasons why they withdrew the code cases, because they recognized that they had to develop acceptance criteria for the actual materials that they were being used, and they couldn't just borrow the acceptance criteria for pressure vessel seals. And the other issue that was a problem with these materials was they never considered what would happen with the mechanical properties of these heat-treated alloys if they were exposed to elevated temperatures. And so, you know, the thing I want to point out here is that the American Society of Mechanical Engineers Boiler and Pressure Vessel Code has required the use of temperature-dependent mechanical properties for heat-treated aluminum alloys since 1999. So I can't tell you why JSME completely ignored that, because it was it was approved by ASME 10 years prior to these code cases being approved by JSME and then later being withdrawn. They really should have known that was an issue. And with respect to this aluminum metal matrix composite, this boron-containing material under ASME N673, that was approved by JSME in April of 2009, but that code case was never accepted by the NRC, and that code case shows up in our regulatory guide, Reg Guide 1.193, and the earliest time it shows up is in Revision 2, which is dated October of 2007. And that code case was not approved. Any code case that shows up in the Reg Guide 1.193 is not approved by the NRC. So JSME should have known that the NRC did not approve that code case 2 years prior to them accepting that code case. And the reasons for that code case not being accepted are included in the regulatory guide document. So the narrative being presented here is that, you know, we're allowing something to be used that was not allowed by JSME. In fact, the opposite is true. We required additional requirements for aluminum alloys, time-dependent mechanical properties above 300 degrees Fahrenheit, 10 years before JSME approved these code cases. And with respect to the aluminum metal matrix composite material that JSME approved in 2009, we didn't approve that 2 years prior, so the entire narrative here is incorrect. I encourage you to go to look at Reg Guide 1.197, and it'll tell you clearly what the story was with at least that material. The other materials in the JSME code cases are publicly available. They're not applicable to any system that we've approved, because the systems that we approved that use borated aluminum alloys for neutron absorbers do not rely on the mechanical properties of those materials. those oriented aluminum alloys or Boral or whatever metal matrix composite being used for a neutron absorber material is basically attached to a welded stainless steel basket that's designed and constructed according to ASME code under subsection NG, and it's a welded stainless steel system. So the stainless steel material is what carries the load. And in all of these systems where we have approved the use of oriented aluminum alloys, Boral, boron-containing metal matrix composites, in any system that we're talking about here referencing in this license application, they do not rely on those, the mechanical properties of those neutron absorber materials at all. And that's clearly stated in the safety analysis report of those systems.
The next question comes from Michael Keegan. Your line is open.
A couple housekeeping questions and requests. Thank you for the, that was very interesting. Can we get these transcribed? These are very important meetings, and they need to be fully documented and offer the opportunity to be able to reply and rebut to your citation of Part 71. So that's one request I had. And then another request, maybe they could, two birds, one stone, as I say, an annotated bibliography with links to the discussion you just provided and to support what's the meeting of today. It's a bit of the not having those documents readily available is tough to participate. But your reference to Part 71 seems, in the regulation, just seems so, the regulation seems so tautological, so circling, pulls back on itself. But it remains a data-free zone. The dissertation you just gave went on about proxy metals, not the actual testing and observation of the existing situation. And to my knowledge, the best state of the art is that you've got a high burn up fuel experiment underway in Northana, which is halfway into a 20-year experiment. So it's not known what's going on there. So it just seems that these arguments keep folding back on themselves, and then you go into priority proprietary session closed, and the public is left in the dark. That's the classic mushroom tree. You're kept in the dark. Every now and then, they throw some manure on you. So if you put those two requests, transcripts, because this is very important stuff, this is going to be forever, and a bibliography with links, that would be most helpful. So thank you.
So, Mr. Kay, this is John Wayne. Thank you very much for your comments. So, for us, in terms of, so what we do is after a public meeting, we would put a meeting summaries together based on the conversations that we have had and in exchange with the student applicants and us, and also comments that you have provided it. But so in terms of transcripts and things like that, for public meetings, we don't do that. But in terms of proprietary versus non-proprietary, so when the applicants submit the information, there's some information that they deem as proprietary because of either business reason or because of trade secret information. So we the NRC will determine whether or not those information should be categorized as proprietary, and if we do, then we will conduct the meeting under that. So, Mary.
You can provide a reference to the Reg Guide 1.193 that addresses the one code case. So that's on our publicly available website, but we can provide an additional session number.
Okay. in the meeting summary, Mr. Kagan, where you can provide a reference, spot for one, an ML number for them.
The next question comes from Donna Gilmore. Your line is open.
Hi. Yeah, Daryl, on this basket issue, did you, has the NRC written up something on this issue so we can put it to rest? It would be very useful to have your statement of what you saw as the problem in Japan and why it's different, and have like a written document that would be a more professional way to handle it, and that could be shared. And otherwise, the issues, I don't see it as closed. I mean, the fact that you can't inspect the canisters to confirm any of your assumptions, it doesn't give us a lot of comfort here. And I had, and then on the, and so we're also assuming that none of the fuel has become damaged and stored. Now, I know that the non-high burnup transfer caps that are approved, not transfer, transport caps that are approved, they don't assume that the canister remains intact. They don't even assume that. So I don't think there's anything, I'm not aware of what you're referring to when the transport cast approved for lower burnout fuel didn't even require the canister be intact.
That you are correct. For a transportation system for fissile material, one or two things has to occur. The applicant has to show that with ingress of water as a moderator to the maximum extent credible or possible, whatever the regulation says, they have to show that the system remains subcritical. For high burnup systems, which again, not applicable to this application, there have been cases where a moderator exclusion option was used, and in that case, the applicant has to show that the canister, which in this case would be used for moderator exclusion, is intact, and they can demonstrate that. And there's a couple of ways they can demonstrate that, but most of the applicants have essentially been developing non-destructive evaluation methodologies for assessing the canister for transportation in the most conditions. So that's not part of this application. And as far as the answer to your question goes on the JSME, again, you know, this is just, it's not applicable to anything that we've approved, because we don't look at those materials for mechanical properties, and the documentation is in the FSAR. The applicant clearly states that, you know, they're not relying on these materials for any mechanical properties, and that was really the issue for the Japanese Society of Mechanical Engineers, is that it wasn't that the systems weren't safe; it's just that the evaluations that were conducted, or the basis for the code case, was weak in terms of evaluating mechanical properties. So we haven't formally written up something. We've had some discussion on doing something like that, but I can't tell you what the process will be on that. You know, we can't spend our time writing up positions on things that are not applicable to any application. I don't think the applicants want to pay for that, and I'm pretty sure my management doesn't want to pay for that. So we have to go with what we have.
Christine, so it's 1:51 now. So I think we'll have to conclude the comments and questions. But we want to thank you, everybody, for your comments and questions. And for some of the information that was asked, we will put that in the meeting summary and provide information, for example, links associated with the questions that Mr. Blitzer asked. So with that, thank you very much again, and we are going to transition to the closed portion.